Hello, everybody. This is Salil Tripathi from Cambridge, Massachusetts in the United States at the Harvard Kennedy School. And I'm talking today with Professor John Ruggie. Professor Ruggie, of course, is known for his work on having helped develop the guiding principles at the UN when he was a special representative for business and human rights, and is the architect of the framework under which Protect, Respect, Remedy became the watchwords for everybody who works on business and human rights. Distinguished record earlier at the UN itself, where he was one of the original thinkers that led to the launch of the Global Compact, and a scholar on global governance. And most important is that he chairs the Institute for Human Rights and Business. John, my first question to you is that it's 5 years now to the Guiding Principles. It was a tremendous achievement to get governments to agree to a framework which they had not negotiated, which they had not written, but an outsider had written, and not only to agree, but to agree unanimously at the Council. That was a significant achievement. 5 years on, are you satisfied with the pace? Is it where you thought things would be 5 years later?
Salil, to be honest with you, I didn't have any idea where it would be 5 years hence. Am I pleased by where we are? I am. I think we have moved the debate and the practices considerably over time. People are speaking the same language. The notion of human rights due diligence is widely understood today. And practiced. We've also pushed the issue well beyond the sort of traditional confines of business and human rights. As some of your listeners may know, we recently worked with FIFA,
right,
the global football organization, the governing body of global football, who have now included in their statutes, their constitution, a commitment to respect all internationally recognized human rights, and to include human rights criteria into bidding requirements for the World Cup, and to use the guiding principles as a template. I would never have dreamed 5 years ago that sort of development would occur. So no. I'm satisfied in that respect. Of course, I'm dissatisfied because there is so much more to be done, and both in terms of the geographical spread of the guiding principles and also in terms of the depth of their incorporation into practices.
Can you build on that a little bit? I mean, geographical, as in moving beyond U.S., Europe, and Australia, is that what?
It has to some extent. So, you know, as you know, was it last year, the Chinese Chamber of Commerce for Minerals and Metals, or something to that effect, issued guidance for the overseas operations of Chinese mining companies. And essentially, they said, follow the guiding principles throughout your operations. So we're making inroads, but it's still in sort of non-traditional areas. It's still quite thin. So there's a few companies, there's a few guidance instructions from governments or quasi-governmental agencies, but it's still thin. We need to deepen as well as widen as we go forward.
So was it possible to give more detailed guidance about how to do the due diligence? Because I recall 5 years ago, that was one of the questions that kept coming back to you from people, that yes, we want to do it, how do we do it? And of course, then we had the SHIFT project and IHRB's work on, you know, through the European Commission in three specific sectors. In Myanmar, we did the sector-wide impact assessments trying to implement it. GNI also looks at some of the stuff, and you have other OECD has also started looking at it more seriously. So is that a satisfactory trajectory and pace, or would you want something deeper and more committed?
Well, I think all of the developments that you describe are extremely important. We in the guiding principles themselves, we laid out the basic components of a human rights due diligence process. We couldn't possibly anticipate the specificities that would be required for different sectors, for different geographies, for different levels of development, and so on and so forth. We knew from the beginning that would have to be filled in through experimentation and practice. And I think that's what's happening in the various projects that you described. It's filling in the specificities, because at the end of the day, it isn't a generalized phenomenon. It has to be concretized in a specific time and place.
Now, as a scholar of global governance and an expert on international relations, what do you see happening next as we go forward in terms of embedding the due diligence? Does it have to be regulated? Does it have to be part of a government's expectations? Should it be something that comes out of the UN or the World Bank or something like the IFC performance standards? How do we mainstream it?
Well, it's going to be through multiple channels. It's not going to be through a single channel. And what you see is the notion of due diligence, human rights due diligence, being incorporated in various pieces of regional and national law, for example, mm-hmm. whether it has to do with anti-slavery, whether it has to do with non-financial reporting. These are bits and pieces of due diligence processes being incorporated in as policy requirements and in a growing number of cases as legal requirements.
Now, turning briefly to the state duty to protect, and one of the takeaways for governments was a national action plan, the idea of that, you know, it was expected, and countries have slowly begun to start publishing them and so on. One criticism is that it's nothing but a random survey of what they are doing, or unattainable or poorly defined aspirations of where they want to go next. What would you like to see in a good national action plan? What have you seen that is good, and how can they be made stronger?
Well, I think ideally what a national action plan would do, it would be essentially a gap analysis, mm-hmm. right? That you look at what the principles are that need to be met, and then you do a gap analysis of your own policies and practices and laws to see where there are gaps and where they need to be filled. And the national action plan ideally would fill in those gaps.
Mm-hmm.
There hasn't really been a single one that does all of that. So what I would say so far, I mean, there are better ones and not so better ones mm-hmm. out there today. And I don't want to talk about.
And you're still a diplomat about this. You wouldn't say
right.
which is which.
No, I wouldn't do that.
Okay.
Nevertheless, one thing I do know is that in each case so far, the process has been extraordinarily important.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you take a government such as the government of the United States. It's vast. It is internally fragmented. And working on the National Action Plan actually forces a coherence of internal debates, the likes of which you've never had before. And so, you know, Marshall McLuhan used to say the medium is the message.
Yes.
So in this case, the medium is as important in many cases as the actual message has been.
One of the questions you often asked when, you know, you had NGOs or even business organizations telling you the problems ahead or how certain things cannot be done and so on. At all the consultations that you had in the leading up to the GPs, was what do I do Monday morning, or what does a company do on Monday morning? 5 years on, GPs, due diligence framework, monitoring and tracking performance, having a grievance system, are those the good basic building blocks for what can be done on Monday morning? Or do we still have a problem, what we were talking about earlier today, the whole issue of victims still seeking justice?
Of course.
And dealing with that, this proposal of a treaty, is that the way forward?
Well, as you know, I've always...
I think it's two questions in one, I know, but yeah.
I've always argued that there is no single silver bullet.
Right.
And that a multiplicity of channels have to be employed. And with regards to an international treaty, it's been my view all along that further international legalization is both inevitable and desirable. The question isn't should there be further legalization, but what and how. So my argument with the treaty proposal and the arguments behind it is I wish they would stop talking about a treaty and start talking about the treaty. What is supposed to be in it?
Mm-hmm.
What does it intend to regulate? You can't throw the entire issue of business and human rights into a single international legal instrument and expect it to come out in a sufficiently practical way to make any difference to real people in real places. So I wish the debate would start addressing specific issues that a treaty could deal with, as opposed to simply arguing for legalization writ large.
So in this framework that we have, where we don't have a treaty, we do have the guiding principles, and we do have companies groping to figure out how to move forward. Is it now time to start evaluating corporate performance in some way? I have two examples that I wanted to bring up. One is that Oxfam recently started ranking companies about sustainability and actually started, you know, giving kind of, you know, not seals of approval per se, but saying that, you know, you're doing something right, which is a remarkable change from where we were 15 years ago or 20 years ago, where respectable NGOs wouldn't even want to give such a certification. I mean, this was a recent report that came out about, it was about environmental issues, relatively easier to measure. And the other is a project that IHRB is involved with, the corporate human rights benchmarking. Mm-hmm. Are those helpful? And if so, in what way?
Well, of course they're helpful. I mean, when Oxfam started the Behind the Brands campaign, yes, for example, the first year, Nestle beat out Unilever for first place.
Yes.
And Unilever said, that's never going to happen again. Yes. We're going to be first. So yes, there obviously there is a competitive drive. And that's a good thing. But we need to keep in mind that the Behind the Brand, Behind the Brands campaign includes, I believe, 10 companies.
Mm-hmm.
There are somewhere between 70,000 and 80,000, yes, multinationals in the world. So that's one thing. And secondly, many of these initiatives are extremely helpful, I think, in helping to reduce the incidence of, mm-hmm, human rights abuses. But we still haven't made sufficient progress on the access to remedy part.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so much harder, and requires work at the national level as well as the international level.
And that's where the states do need to step up,
absolutely,
right? Indeed, because
absolutely,
you can't have, I mean, however well-intentioned, if an abuse has taken place, a quiet and private arrangement between the victims and the company, where the law is completely, it takes a backseat. I mean, which is one of the issues that comes up in the context of national contact points, that, mm-hmm, you know, they can deal with certain types of abuses, but not all. So the law has to be there,
mm-hmm,
and national, rather than debating the whole extraterritoriality,
right,
I would think.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So I agree with that fully, and there's a lot of work to be done at the national level, as well as regional and international levels.
So 6 years of developing the guiding principles, 5 years after.
God, has it really been that long?
It's been 11 years. Are you, do you still finding challenging? Do you still finding very interesting? What are the two or three things you would like to see in the next 5 years? Let's put it that way.
Well, I wish we had, first of all, I wish we had better documentation. I'm convinced that from a practical point of view, that relative to the numbers of people and numbers of companies, the incidence of human rights abuses may be declining as a result of the adoption of various measures by countries and by companies. But we don't have good documentation. So until we do, we're still going to end up having theological arguments about this is the best solution or that, mm-hmm, is the best solution. That's one thing. Secondly, I'm personally committed to keeping on driving the ideas behind the guiding principles into totally new spheres of life.
Looking like football, right?
Yes,
Sphere we're talking about.
Exactly. You know, so after FIFA comes the International Olympics, right? And
right,
then cricket, right?
And yes, of course.
You're going to join me on that project.
Absolutely,
right?
I will. Yeah, you bet. Yeah.
But, you know, the
because there are issues of potential use of child labor in manufacturing of the sports equipment, because much of it is made in South Asia.
Right. There you go. So even while we work to deepen the application and the understanding of the guiding principles, and even as we move toward policy requirements and legal requirements, I want to also expand literally the space of social life that is covered by ideas behind the guiding principles.
That's a terrific note to end on. Thank you. All the best. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you, Salil.
Thank you.